This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the Malcolm X grassroots movement says Ferguson, Missouri, is a reminder that blacks need to organize for self-defense. Evidence shows that standing up to injustice is good for your health. And Dr. Gerald Horn says, if you're black, you likely have relatives in Cuba. But first, President Obama claims the rise of ISIS and the Islamic State gives him the right to bomb Iraq as he pleases. We spoke with David Swanson, the veteran anti-war activist and publisher of the influential website War is a Crime. What role is the U.S. Congress playing in this new U.S. air war in Iraq?
It's kind of a slap in the face because Congress, the House, not the Senate, but the House voted just about 2 weeks before this new bombing campaign was launched to forbid any illegal, that is unconstitutional, war, already forbidden, of course, by the Constitution, by the president without any congressional declaration of war. So they passed that. And then 2 weeks later, while they're out of town, President Obama starts something that he could have started while they were in town, and he could have asked them, and his pretense that it's always an emergency, as in Libya, as in Syria, and so forth, is just not credible. But to his relief, I suppose, just about every single member of Congress, right down to Bernie Sanders and Barbara Lee, said, we support what you're doing. So the possibility of Congress pushing back immediately became much more unlikely and much more of a difficult ask for activists, which is quite a turn from the position that Congress took on Syria, the position that even the Senate took earlier this year on toughening sanctions and moving into a likely war with Iran, and the rhetoric that was coming out of the House just a couple of weeks ago. So this is a president who gets away with these things because he's a Democrat and because he is claiming to be doing small wars and efficient wars and robotized wars that don't risk the sort of lives that we're supposed to care about, Americans. And so we've gotten to a place with the public as well, where the public doesn't want any major ground war, any risk to U.S. lives, but is okay with launching missiles at anybody, anywhere, anytime, regardless of the fact that countless innocent people are going to die in the process, and the process is not going to be controllable, and it's likely going to escalate.
And on Capitol Hill, the opposition has evaporated, even Barbara Lee, as you mentioned, Barbara Lee being the only person on the Hill to vote against the invasion of Afghanistan. Even Barbara Lee is mute on the subject.
Yeah, and worse than mute. And, you know, you have these heroic moments where we're 50 years ago this month that the House voted unanimously and the Senate voted with two exceptions for the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, knowing what that would mean to the people of Vietnam, 4 million dead, as that was allowed to go on without any congressional resistance for years. And yet one senator, Wayne Morse, one of the two who voted the right way, stood up and laid out all the facts and was denounced as a crackpot, just as Barbara Lee found that moment of courage on Afghanistan, just as Jeanette Rankin found that moment of courage on World War II, having also voted against World War I. But these moments of heroism come and go and depend quite a bit on the circumstances, including partisan alignments, the party of the president, the type of war, the public mood, and so forth. Finding someone who is, as a matter of principle and wisdom and understanding, against war in all of its evil is quite hard to do. We know that Congressman Kucinich was closer in that direction than many of his colleagues and was driven out in large part by military spending on the campaign of arrival.
And so it seems that the War Powers Act is null and void at both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue, at the White House and with the Congress.
Well, they claim that it's not. And of course, the Constitution, as I read it, forbids any sort of presidential war without congressional declaration and approval. And under Article 6 makes both the UN Charter and the Kellogg-Briand Pact, the supreme law of the land, as treaties to which the United States is party to, all of these wars violating the UN Charter, and any conceivable war violating the Kellogg-Briand Pact. But the War Powers Resolution of 1973 is understood radically differently by anybody you ask. And under the president's interpretation, his wars are emergencies, and they comply with the War Powers Act, and he's reporting to Congress on what he's doing, and that's all that's needed. And according to Congress, including Congresswoman Lee, that's all well and good and not a big problem. There are even those who interpret the War Powers Resolution to refer only to U.S. troops on the ground and not to missiles. Harold Coe, one of Obama's lawyers in recent years, has pursued that interpretation and told Congress that dropping bombs on Libya would not be war or hostilities. These would be somehow non-hostile bombs. So if you're going to allow lawyers to say that black is white and white is black and up is down, you can comply with just about any law you want.
In defending his Libya bombing and claiming that it did not fall under the War Powers Act, President Obama essentially said that there is no war if Americans are not killed.
That's right. I had one of the key authors, a former Republican congressman, on my radio show a few weeks ago, one of the key authors of the War Powers Act, and this was certainly not his interpretation or understanding of anyone's interpretation at the time, but this is one way that you can comply with the law. You can weaken it to the point almost of meaninglessness. So if you haven't got U.S. troops dying yet, then you haven't got a violation of the War Powers Act. Well, that's only going to hold up in a corrupt sort of court. But as William Bundy, a CIA, a so-called defense guy, said back during the Vietnam War, there is an advantage to spilling U.S. blood to those who want to escalate a war. And I know that ISIS had to be aware that slitting throats on camera would result in more bombing, just as President Obama had to be aware that blowing men, women, and children up with 500-pound bombs would result in slitting throats. The beneficiaries of this escalation, which is entirely predictable, are the weapons makers. There are people, no matter what Paul Krugman says in the New York Times, there are people who profit from war. They just aren't most of us.
The administration is framing the more recent bombings in Iraq as part of a humanitarian stance by the United States, something they say about everything the U.S. military does these days. But you point out that minority groups in Iraq, like the Yazidis, were actually pushed towards insecurity by the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003.
Oh, there's no question that the invasion and occupation in the years following 2003 resulted in massive deaths and virtual elimination of a number of minority groups, including Christian groups in Iraq. So for the United States to take this moral high ground and say we're going to use a little clean war to prevent a genocide and violence, as if the Pentagon never engages in violence, and a massive level of violence, as if the 500,000 to 1.5 million Iraqis killed during the U.S. occupation of just those years, and just in excess of the death rate that existed following previous U.S. wars and sanctions, has been remotely approached by the level of killing engaged in by these terrorist groups. The question, of course, is whether dropping the bombs is going to help these people or make things worse. And you have a U.S. military that is clearly largely uninformed about what is happening on the ground there, shows up on the mountain expecting to find 20, 30,000 people and finds 4,000, most of them having inconveniently escaped too soon. It does not have any idea where ISIS is or what it's doing, that runs a rescue mission to rescue hostages and finds nobody home, and yet claims to know exactly where it's dropping bombs and who it's dropping bombs on, and that it's killing only the proper people and they don't need to bother counting the bodies. And so it's extremely unconvincing. And of course, it's not a solution that lasts beyond next week. You have to keep dropping bombs forever. And as you drop those bombs and generate more enemies and more hostility and more thirst for vengeance on both sides, what becomes of those people? So there are other solutions. This idea that you can only drop bombs or do nothing is a very American idea. Other people around the world see crises and think let's send in negotiators, let's send in aid, let's send in, if necessary, police, but not 500-pound bombs. That has not been shown ever to have bettered a situation in the past, and yet there's this constant will to believe it will in the current instance.
One would think that the United States would know a great deal about ISIS, since ISIS in its present form would not exist except for the U.S. desire for regime change in Syria.
Yeah, I mean, this is the crazy thing always about this notion of the U.S. riding in on a white horse to intervene in a situation that has resulted from the irrational medieval barbarism of foreigners. The United States created the sectarian divide, created the hostile level of violence, created the deprivation and resentment and illegitimate government in Baghdad, has been supplying ISIS and allied groups with weaponry in Syria, or what used to be Syria, has been supplying weaponry to Iraq, which has been seized by ISIS. So if you work in the U.S. weapons industry, you have to be proud not just of the wars of your own country, which you may bow down in allegiance to, but of being a provider of 79% of the weaponry that goes into the Middle East and the number one provider of weaponry to ISIS. So if we think of the Middle East as a violent place, and it certainly is, but it is also a very heavily armed place, most of those arms coming from the United States and most of the rest from its allies, and a place that is heavily exploited. And Paul Krugman tells the New York Times that wars are not fought for economic reasons because wars do not benefit the populations of the countries that wage them. Well, if there were not oil in Iraq, we would not be having this conversation. And the fact that that oil does not benefit you and me and most people of the United States or most people of Iraq, for that matter, is irrelevant to the fact that there are motivations of profit and greed that feed into the motivations of political advantage and domination and machismo and sadism that drive these wars. And one side or the other, the bomb droppers or the throat slitters, is going to have to move to a higher ground and break out of the cycle of violence. And right now, it doesn't look like it's going to be the bomb droppers.
That was David Swanson of warisacrime.org. In 2012, the Malcolm X grassroots movement issued its groundbreaking report, Operation Ghetto Storm, which found that every 28 hours, a black person is killed by a cop or an individual acting under color of law. Kali Okuno was a co-author of the report. In the wake of events in Ferguson, Missouri, Okuno says the Malcolm X grassroots movement is reasserting its position that self-defense must be integral to any strategy for black empowerment.
Well, first and foremost, it's right for our people to rebel. And this is a long time in coming. I think that it's boiled over in Ferguson as a result of transformations in our people's consciousness after seeing Trayvon Martin, Zimmerman, getting exonerated for that, after Troy Davis, after the prison revolts that have been going on over the past several years. I think there's a transformation of people's consciousness, particularly our young folks. They've had enough of the brutality, enough of just being systematically excluded, being treated as disposable by the society. And I think they're putting the power that be in Ferguson on notice. And as a result of the international media, in local grassroots media, they send that message, I think, loud and clear in many different ways, even despite the confusion that many are trying to interject in the equation. We're trying to blunt the brute strength of the young folks' righteous outrage with message for calm and let the legal justice system work and all these kind of shortcomings. I think it's very clear that our people want justice. They're willing to act for it. You know, what I do see, however, you know, and this is not the fault of the young folks by any stretch of the imagination, that there's a serious kind of lack of both agreement but also clarity on what to do in a moment like this. What is the strategy? What is the tactic? You know, what are the end goals besides just having the police officer arrested and convicted? So there's the political struggle that I see being kind of waged on the ground in Ferguson. And I think forces like us have to try to interject in a solid way and make sure that in the battle of ideas that's taking place, that there's some clear goals that put out there and some clear strategies that put out there that really let folks know what happened to Mike is not an individual incident, it's episodic, it's systemic, it's part and parcel of how this empire project was built and how it seeks to contain and keep us on the hill, and that we have to look at the system in its entirety, and not just look at it on an episodic basis. We got to organize ourselves to be able to deal with it in that manner.
And the Malcolm X grassroots movement has said emphatically that any strategy must include self-defense.
Absolutely. This is nothing new to our people. That's one of the things we're trying to reassert. Going back to Reconstruction and even before, this has been part and parcel of what we know we have to do in the face of white supremacy, in the face of this whole brutality that the capitalist system has and has for us in particular. If we, in any form or fashion, think we're going to make it out of this and thrive as a people, first and foremost, we got to defend our community, defend our own lives. But we're trying to reorient people to get back to that sense of justice and start working on a community level, block by block, you know, neighborhood by neighborhood, to get themselves organized to deal with the police and to deal with the other forms of containment and surveillance that's perpetuated on us by the state and increasingly by corporations that we got to deal with. You know, so there's some tried and true methods that we have to go back to. I think, quite frankly, of getting to know your neighbors and not just doing that, getting people prepared for when the police do roll up in your neighborhood and looking at, you know, our young men and women and hemming them up, what is the appropriate response to make sure that they don't only put their hands on our youth, but that they don't come back, and how we actually seize control of our own community block by block in our city. You know, that's the way I think we got to approach it.
You're talking about defending our communities from the police. The state police in Missouri rolled out their black captain, Ron Johnson, and he was greeted by some as a community ally and saving grace.
Yeah, well, you know, we've always had certain political and ideological differences in our community. Those are going to continue to exist. The state knew what it was doing. I thought that was a brilliant tactic on their part to roll him out and give him all the TV coverage and have Diamond and all of whatever that guy's in for CNN, have him drive around with him and stage interviews with some of our youth, you know, to talk about how the police treat them. And they basically just blatantly ignore the cold facts and the truth of what the youth share with. But that's part of the strategy, and I think we got to see it that way. And it's part of the both the political and ideological divisions that exist amongst our people. And I think what I'm seeing is a new level of political confusion that's deliberately being perpetrated by some of these so-called liberal forces out there to blunt and try to contain the righteous anger by youth. You know, but I think there's been some positive things that we've seen, at least in my mind, where the youth in particular have been telling some of these old misleaders to go home. We don't need you here. We don't want you here. We know what you're here for. We know that your boss has sent you here to try to calm us down and tell us to cool out or tell us to go back in the home and let the professionals, quote unquote, negotiate a way to justice. And folks are clear, a good segment of our folks are clear, it seems to me, particularly youth, that doesn't work, probably never has worked, despite them maybe not knowing the history. They know the aspect. So I think that's a positive sign of transformation. I think what has to be kind of infused in it, again, and this is not blaming our youth, those who have some experience and skill in organizing, particularly in forms of self-defense, we have to kind of step up our game and step up our work to reach more of the young folks and build the types of autonomous and fluid organizations that are needed to carry out this work for the future.
There's been a lot of talk about Ferguson being a city that's two-thirds black, but it has only one elected official and only a couple of black policemen. But as black folks were demonstrating in Ferguson, right next door in St. Louis, cops shot down a black man with a fusillade of nine bullets. St. Louis, up until recently, had a black majority, has had black mayors, is represented by a black congressman, and has a lot of black police.
Yeah, and I'm glad you point out all those things. Some of the things that I know I've been trying to bring home, and we've been trying to bring home, and black faces don't necessarily represent in any form or fashion black interest. You know, I think the Black Agenda Report has been doing an excellent job over the years trying to drill this into many of our folks' heads that these misleaders, they're serving somebody else's interest. And at this point, they're consciously doing so, and many of them will tell you that if you really take the time to listen to what they're actually saying in any detail, and more importantly, follow the money, who's paying them, whose docket are they on, what issues are they either promoting or defending or bringing up in Congress and in the legislature. And most of them, if you look at the record, they supported the advance of the police state almost every term. They are getting paid by a lot of those forces to make those decisions. And more concerning, I think, is not just the payoff. I think we got to deal with the fact that there's a whole set of politicians who actually believe in the project, of the Imperial Project. They believe it into their core. Those are the interests that they are advancing. And they do not coincide with the interests of the mass of Black working class people who are totally excluded and becoming more so every day from labor markets and the basic right to life in many respects. You know, look at Detroit, you know, you lose the right to water. You know, without water, there is no life. And that was many a Black politician which helped to facilitate that whole process of the takeover. Just had another example. But this is just part of the political and ideological struggle which is taking place in our community. We should not have any illusions about it. I think we should engage and get prepared to deal with these folks on a political basis and not assume that just because they look like us, they're in unity with our interests. They're not. You know, not of them straight up or not. As I'm saying, not just on the basis of them being bought out or sold out, but you got a new group like Obama who actually believe, you know, the imperial mission and will do whatever it takes to make sure that it succeeds, including killing African people in the United States and throughout the world. That's the cold reality.
Did the refusal of Black folks in Ferguson to be passive in the face of that daylight murder, did it surprise you?
No, not at all. I think we've been seeing a rising tide of that, and I think it's to be expected. And I think, quite honestly, at some point, you know, as the old spiritual says, you know, the rainbow is over. And I think it's the fire next time. I think Ferguson showed us some clear signs of that. And I think that's one of the reasons why a lot of these characters showed up down there to try to contain it and be a buffer and basically kind of act as the police against the people. But that anger, it doesn't surprise me one bit. Someone who grew up in Los Angeles and was part of that generation which witnessed, you know, the rebellion in 1992, that anger has been there. It's not subsiding. Conditions have changed in many communities that got worse. We got a lot of people out there who are young people in particular. They're already not expecting to live long lives. They really don't feel that they got nothing to lose by fighting back. And I think they're going to take front to the stage. They're already doing it to a certain extent in Ferguson. But I think, if anything, what Ferguson is doing is when the next time this powder keg exists, it may be an even more militant kind of outcome than what we're seeing now.
Kali Okuno of the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement. Police can be deadly, but one of the biggest killers of African Americans is stress. Dr. Vernelia Randall, Professor Emeritus of Law at the University of Dayton, Ohio, is author of Dying While Black. It's an exposition of what makes Black people unhealthy, especially the stress of living in a racist society. We asked Dr. Randall if standing up to police power in Ferguson has been therapeutic for the city's Black people.
Yes, and that's exactly what it's an example of. And the problem with being passive is when you react, you can overreact, not in a critical way. But if people go along taking abuse, at some point when the abuse gets too much, when they've been passive too long, the reaction to people on the outside may not seem proportional to what has happened. They don't understand that the reaction is not to the one thing that happened, but to the history of abuse.
And also, the people who are reacting are not necessarily doing it for the observers, but for themselves.
Exactly. That it really is about, and I want us to be less passive. I want us to engage in civil disobedience. I want us to color outside of the lines. That if they're telling us that here's how you can protest, here's how you can do this, then that to me is not civil disobedience. That if you're coloring within the lines that the establishment establishes, then you're putting no pressure on the establishment.
And from that standpoint, what's happening in Ferguson is a mentally healthy activity.
Exactly. And hopefully that other people will begin to engage in it, and that they will then, with this activity, they will then begin to continue. The big problem that I see, and I really do equate this to abuse, is that, like, if you equate it to abusive situations, the big problem is with people, once having engaged in some activity that is empowering to them, they slip back into allowing the abuse to reoccur or not doing anything of significance. And so for me, the question is how do we translate, how do people in Ferguson and the rest of the world translate this to some real change? And I'm not encouraged, because the problem is that we are in a system of oppression that is every bit as onerous as Jim Crow. And we react to the different aspects of it when we do react. So first, we don't react. We go along. Different people who've been killed in the recent months, no significant civil disobedience. And then we have this, but it still is not focused on the total system, not just the cops, but the total system of oppression that we're under. And I don't know how we do that. I don't know if we can.
And so you're saying it is right and healthy to resist, but what about the mental letdown when that resistance does not result, since it's going up against systemic oppression, does not result in immediate relief?
That is the danger. We're in a no-win situation. Take abuse and be healthy, dying from that abuse because of all the stress that has occurred. And I say dying by black because our life expectancy is equivalent to people in Cuba, Bermuda, Jamaica. So we don't have a first world life expectancy. And the CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency, says that the quality of life for the people in country can be measured by their life expectancy. So we have the stress of that. We have the stress of living in this kind of country. But then, on top of that, we have the stress of when we attempt to do stuff that is not effective. So which is better, to go along in your enslavement doing nothing, to put your head down and try to just hope that you can live your life without any significant consequences? Or is it better to join a protest knowing that the likelihood of the protest is not going to make long-term changes, because the problem is a systemic problem, not a individual problem, incidental problem?
But in general, you seem to be saying that people might live longer if they can avoid getting shot down by police by expressing their frustrations and through acts of resistance.
I believe so. I was a public health nurse for a long time, and before I went to law school. And what we know is relieving your stress, even if it's temporary, is always better than allowing the stress to continue unchecked. It's like having a pot on a fire. Yes, you're not getting off the fire when you open the steam valve, but if you open the steam valve, you won't have as much boiling over. And so I think it's healthier to engage in civil disobedience. I think it's healthier to get angry and to express that anger. I think it is unhealthy to bottle it up and to continue moving on.
Professor Vernelia Randall of the University of Dayton. Who are the police directly accountable to? Theoretically, they answer to the mayors of their cities, many of whom are black. Nevertheless, blacks are gunned down by police with alarming frequency in cities all across the country. Bar managing editor Bruce Dixon says the U.S. Conference of Mayors acts as if they bear no responsibility for police abuse of black citizens.
I got an email Friday from former NBA star, husband of the detestable Michelle Rhee, and current mayor of Sacramento, California, and chair of the U.S. Conference of Mayors, Kevin Johnson. It was a five-sentence press release from the U.S. Conference of Mayors on the situation in Ferguson, Missouri. The first sentence expressed heartfelt condolence to the family upon the death of Michael Brown. The second sentence urged a full investigation and applauded the president's announcement of a federal investigation. The third sentence said that the mayors have, quote, a long track record, unquote, of commitment to community policing, and claimed that the mayors try to, quote, identify and implement police department policies which will help prevent such incidents from occurring in the future, unquote. The fourth sentence said that they were working with the President Obama's My Brother's Keeper initiative, and the fifth sentence said that they were the national reps of mayors of cities with over 30,000 people and gave their Facebook and Twitter info. What's wrong with this press release is that the mayors are elected officials who usually give orders to police departments. Mayors, hundreds of them black, are elected by the people and are responsible, directly responsible, for what our disrespectful, brutal, and occasionally murderous police do. Mayors don't have to wring their hands and offer condolences. Mayors, including hundreds of black mayors, can tell their police departments to refuse federal funding tied to the number of low-level drug arrests they make. And mayors can actually get the black Attorney General Eric Holder on the phone to explain why they need it. But they don't. Mayors, including the black ones, don't have to mumble about community policing. They can actually get Jay Johnson, the Morehouse man and the black head of Homeland Security, or somebody from the Pentagon on the phone and tell them to stop sending mine-resistant armored vehicles, machine guns, sonic disruptor weapons, drugs, and stormtrooper gear to their police departments when what they need is more money for jobs, schools, and housing. But they won't. Kevin Johnson and the U.S. Conference of Mayors know very well that My Brother's Keeper isn't even a government program, that it's almost entirely the private charitable contributions of big corporations, some of the same big corporations that won't pay taxes to support schools or health care or infrastructure for everybody, some of the same corporations that got rich milking Detroit and other big cities before abandoning them. Whatever good My Brother's Keeper does can dry up whenever the funders lose interest. They can count, too, so they also know that My Brother's Keeper's entire budget is only a fraction of the yearly increase of the Federal Bureau of Prisons budget during every year of the Obama presidency. The self-referential, self-satisfied, self-justifying press release of the U.S. Conference of Mayors on the occasion of Ferguson is all too typical of our black political class. They don't have answers to poverty or gentrification or mass incarceration or the prison state, even though its intake mechanism is the police departments under their control. They are not even looking for those answers. They're only looking to get contracts, to get elected or reelected, to get congratulated, and to get paid.
Bar managing editor Bruce Dixon. Because of the slave trade, Africans were sold back and forth between Cuba and the United States right up until the U.S. Civil War, according to Dr. Gerald Horn, author of the new book, Race to Revolution, The United States and Cuba During Slavery and Jim Crow. As a result, says Dr. Horn, many black Americans have relatives in Cuba. From the earliest days of the Republic, the United States had ambitions to annex Cuba as a slave state. Dr. Horn says the Americans turned Cuba into a virtual colony after 1898, profoundly affecting the worldview of the Cuban people and the path of their revolution in 1959.
It even goes back before the period of U.S. independence. In my previous book, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, I pointed out that a turning point in the process that led to the revolt of North American settlers against London was when London, the British, temporarily seized Cuba from the Spanish in 1762, but did not allow for free trade in Africans. They wanted the slave trade tightly regulated. And this outraged and enraged the North American mainland settlers, which became part of the Bill of Indictment against London when they revolted in 1776. After the establishment of the United States, which we have been told, the formation of which was a step forward for humanity, quickly became the leader of the African slave trade to Cuba. And what's striking about the United States is that it not only became the leader in the African slave trade to Cuba, as I pointed out in the previous book, The Deepest South, they also became the leader of the African slave trade to Brazil, helping to account for the fact that Brazil has more people of African descent than any other nation outside of Nigeria. What's remarkable about that process is how the United States also extended the territory for capturing Africans from the west of Africa, going down from the bulge of Africa, the area around Senegal, for example, all the way down to Angola, but then crossing and circling the Cape of Southern Africa and going into Mozambique and going into Madagascar and becoming the leading economic force on the island of Zanzibar as early as the 1840s, even though the so-called Arab slave trade had established itself in Zanzibar centuries earlier. This is a remarkable story, and one of the purposes of my book is to try to enlist our Cuban friends and comrades in our journey to claim reparations for the descendants of enslaved Africans here in North America, because the Cubans, too, have a claim against North America, and we would like to use their noted and celebrated diplomatic and political pull in this process. I should also say that the Black Americans here in North America, whether they know it or not, probably have relatives in Cuba, because we all know about the breakup of families of African descent, selling the mother and keeping the father, or vice versa. And if you look at the history of Texas in particular, Texas, as you know, broke away from Mexico in 1836, not least because Mexico was moving towards abolition of slavery. Mexico had a president of African descent, Vicente Guerrero, approximately two centuries before Barack Obama was elected in the United States. And after the independence of Texas, Texas became a slave trading Walmart in so many ways. Ships plied the waters repeatedly from Galveston, Texas, into Cuba, taking Africans back and forth, thousands upon thousands upon thousands. And I suspect that there are many on this side of the Florida Straits, that is to say in the United States of America, who have relatives unbeknownst to them in Cuba. Hopefully the knowledge of that will bring our peoples closer together and lead to a day when this criminal and illegal blockade against Cuba is finally terminated.
Yes, the international American slave trade was officially terminated in the early 1800s, but of course it continued straight up until the Civil War, and Texas was one of the centers of that trade.
Not only up until the Civil War, concluding in 1865, but as you know in the book, I bring forward evidence to suggest that U.S. slave traders, even after the conclusion of the Civil War, continued trying to trade Africans into Cuba. In fact, I show evidence that what we would call Black Americans were kidnapped after the abolition of slavery in the United States. They were presumably free and then taken into slavery in Cuba, where slavery doesn't end until the 1880s. This should not come as a surprise because, as I pointed out in an earlier book, The White Pacific, U.S. Imperialism and Black Slavery in the South Seas After the Civil War, after the U.S. Civil War, you had these U.S. slave traders who went to the South Seas, that is to say, to what we refer to as Polynesia and Melanesia, and began kidnapping dark-skinned people and taking them into bonded labor in Fiji and in Queensland, Australia, when the then influential Kingdom of Hawaii interceded on behalf of these Melanesians and Polynesians. That kingdom was then overthrown, and then, of course, we know it became a U.S. state by 1959. The whole history of slavery and slave trading captained by U.S. nationals needs to be better known, not least because it explodes this mythology of somehow the United States being a great leap forward for humanity when it was formed. In order to maintain that premise, you have to maintain the dueling premise that Africans and dark-skinned people are not a part of humanity, which, of course, is the essential premise of slavery and the slave trade.
And during key periods of history, we see Great Britain acting to one degree or another as a kind of policeman of the slave trade, and the United States is the greatest perpetrator.
I've just written the first few sentences of a new book I'm writing on Haiti. And a premise of this book, as has been a premise of other books that I've written, is that Londoners were quick to grasp the essential meaning of the Haitian Revolution, which was the jig was up with regard to slavery and the slave trade, and it was time to redeploy capital elsewhere. The United States of America, which was established in no small part to perpetrate and perpetuate slavery, found it difficult to absorb that lesson. This led to what appears to be an anomaly. That is to say that the monarchy in London becomes the cop on the beat with regard to stopping the slave trade, and the so-called progressive Republicans here in North America become the major scofflaws in that regard. That even continues in this century, where when the 200th anniversary of the ending of the transatlantic slave trade was marked just a few years ago, it was marked ceremoniously in London with the Prime Minister and the Queen both appearing in ceremonies. It went unremarked here in the United States, which was the leader of the international slave trade and supposedly is the guardian of progressive humanity. But in many ways, it gets worse because August 2014 marks the 200th anniversary of the burning and sacking of Washington, D.C., by a joint team of British redcoats and enslaved Africans in the District of Columbia. That is to say, you know that during the War of 1812, Washington and London were at sword's point, and as happened during the so-called Revolutionary War from 1776 until the founding of the United States, the Africans sided with London to the point where they helped London burn the White House and then send President James Madison and his garrulous spouse, Dolly, fleeing into the streets just one step ahead of the posse. And then, of course, hundreds of these enslaved Africans, not only from Washington, but from the area stretching from Washington down to Savannah, Georgia, then escaped on British ships to settle in Trinidad, where their descendants still reside. In fact, when I gave a book signing some months ago, on my book, Negro Comrades of the Crown, some of the descendants of those Trinidadian Africans came to my book signing to fill me in further on what had happened to their families over the past two centuries.
So 1968 was not the first time that blacks burned Washington.
Oh, not at all. Not at all. In fact, as we reflect upon these unfortunate incidents in New York with the chokehold slaying of Eric Garner, and Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, and Ezell Ford in Los Angeles, I think it's long past time to detect a pattern that stretches back to history, and recognizing that the African population has been perceived, perhaps not incorrectly, as an enemy of a slaveholding republic and as an enemy of slavery and the slave trade upon which this nation was founded. And it's understandable why black people are against slavery and the slave trade. What is a bit more perplexing is why today in 2014, that basic lesson has not been ingested, which would help to shed light upon all of these police killings, which bid fair to become worse as the economic situation deteriorates in this country, as anxiety flows in light of the eroding international position of the United States. And until we grasp that nettle, I'm afraid that we won't be able to see the broader picture, and it'll turn us into opportunist tacticians as opposed to bold strategists.
The desire to annex Cuba, particularly before U.S. emancipation, was not limited to fringes of the slaveocracy. It was a mainstream kind of demand.
Well, absolutely. You have to realize that despite propaganda to the contrary, slavery united North and South. The Africans were deposited in Dixie, but the slave trade was financed from places like Rhode Island and places like New York in particular. I should also mention New Orleans in this context as well. And there were those who felt that the United States should not only annex Cuba and have it become a slave state in these United States of America, but the more ambitious amongst them, the annexationists with real hair on their chests, felt that the United States should annex the whole hemisphere from northern Canada down to Tierra del Fuego in Argentina. And fortunately, their ambitious plans were thwarted. I should also say that the United States, in this book that I'm writing now in Haiti, had the intention of annexing the island of Hispaniola, which Haiti and Dominican Republic now share. First, they were going to annex the Dominican Republic circa 1870 and then go on from there to annex Haiti. And then the plan was to deport most of the U.S. Negro population to that island. And that particular plan only failed by a whisper. And given that we know that, for example, in certain islands in the Caribbean, Guadeloupe, for example, you had slavery abolished, say, in the late 18th century, then it came back, I think that we should always be alert to these noxious, obnoxious plans by our antagonists, because who knows when they will be revived.
After emancipation, Cuba became less attractive as a slave property. Of course, it could not be, but there were still strong currents urging annexation.
Yes, and these particularly come into being in the 1890s when Cuba, particularly the Cubans of African descent like Antonio Maceo, are fighting the Spanish colonialists, fighting, first they had fought to abolish slavery, then they were fighting for independence. But as so often happens throughout history, the United States watches as the Cubans and the Spanish punch each other into submission. And then in 1898, the United States swoops in and knocks out both and claims the island of Cuba. It becomes a de facto U.S. colony as opposed to a de jure U.S. colony, which was the sad fate and is the sad fate of Puerto Rico. But even there are contradictions. One is that a historic fear in North America, in the United States, was the fear of a process encapsulated in the term Africanization. That is to say that Cuba had too many black people. Interestingly enough, they had so many black people because of the manic energy of U.S. slave dealers. But that Cuba, as a result of having so many black people, would become a twin of Haiti, which could then challenge more forcefully white supremacy on the North American mainland. So after the United States takes over Cuba in the late 1890s, they help to engineer a process that brings more Europeans to the island, some of which are the ancestors of the family of the Castro brothers, interestingly enough, to show you how these plans can backfire. The plans backfire as well because the United States, after taking over Cuba in a de facto sense, seeks to implant a militant form of Jim Crow on the island. This did not go down very well in Cuba. And part of the thesis of my book, Race to Revolution, is that that attempted implantation of Jim Crow helps to accelerate a revolutionary process that culminates on January 1st, 1959. I should also mention the close ties over the decades between Black Americans and the island, not only, as already noted, in terms of broken families, where unbeknownst to many of us, we probably have relatives in Cuba, but also the abolitionist forces like Frederick Douglass and Martin Delaney, who kept a keen eye on Cuba and protested vigorously against the barbarism, not only of the Spanish colonialists, but also the attempts by what were called filibusters, which were no more than gangsters from the North American mainland, to invade Cuba in the 19th century and oust the Spanish and take over Cuba on behalf of U.S. slave traders and slave dealers and slave owners. Martin Delaney, for example, wrote a novel called Blake, which may be to this very day at the top of the pyramid in terms of novels written by Black Americans challenging Richard Wright's Native Son or any of the works by Toni Morrison. But it puts forward this idea not only of unity across the Florida Straits between Africans and Cuba and Africans and North America, but also puts forth this idea of that kind of alliance helping to be an alliance that drives world history. And if you look at the role that Cuba played in liberating Southern Africa, for example, some 25-odd years ago at the Battle of Cuito Cunavale in southern Angola, where the Cuban troops allied with the Angolan forces and Namibian forces and South African forces to inflict a stinging defeat on the apartheid army, with many Black Americans, including myself, I might add, helping to generate support against U.S. intervention at that very sensitive moment in world history, leading ultimately to the liberation of Namibia, the first democratic elections in South Africa in 1994, you can see that Martin Delaney had a certain presence of mind when he wrote that novel, Blake. This relationship between Black Americans and Cuba continues through the 20th century. It continues with Langston Hughes, for example, the Harlem Bard, who was very close to the Afro-Cuban writer Nicolas Guillen. In fact, they are in Spain together in the 1930s during the Spanish Civil War, as was Paul Robeson, by the way. You have the many baseball players who played baseball in Cuba when they could not play in North America because of racist laws. You have the many musicians, for example, Fats Navarro, of Cuban descent but born in Key West, Florida, who made a major contribution to this music we call jazz. There are so many ties between Cuba and Black Americans, but unfortunately, because of the criminal blockade imposed upon the island, some of those ties have withered. But I'm hoping that the publication of this book will lead to an efflorescence of those ties.
Yes, when the United States took control of Cuba after 1898, the white American obsession with mongrelization led them to impose an American-style segregation. And might that have increased a black consciousness among black Cubans to a degree more intense than in much of the rest of Latin America?
Well, it is striking that with regard to religious practices in particular, there are more what might be called the holdovers from African religion that are still flourishing in Cuba, but to a degree have been extinguished in the United States of America. I should also say that given Cuba's enormous foreign aid to Africa, and Cuba's only an island of about 12 million people, and yet if you go to certain places like Namibia, Angola, South Africa, Zimbabwe, you find that many of the doctors are of Cuban descent, many of them Afro-Cubans. And so in many ways, Cubans have more direct ties with Africa, particularly in 2014, than many black Americans do, more concrete ties as opposed to, say, rhetorical ties. Cuba has very close relations with Brazil, as noted, has the largest black population outside of Nigeria. In fact, Brazil and Cuba are in a diplomatic alliance against the United States, although, of course, Brazil would be reluctant to acknowledge what is obvious to most of us. So, yes, there are very close ties between Cuba and Africa. And I should also say that one of the points that I make in this book is that a significant episode in Black Cuban history, the so-called race war of 1912, May, June 1912, when thousands of Cubans of African descent are massacred. What I do when I talk about that tragic episode is point out that it was the United States that was in charge of Cuba. It was U.S. corporations who felt threatened by the rise and upsurge of Afro-Cuban consciousness, and it was they who helped to generate this massacre of Black people in Cuba. And I'm hoping that when the Cubans get hold of my book, that'll be part of the bill of indictment against the United States, hopefully leading to claims for reparations.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. And while you're there, check out the latest episode of Black Agenda Television. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Martin Nwoga.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.